Let me ask you one question. How difficult do you think is it to create a meaningful overnight success as an entrepreneur?
But I think the dilution sort of you can only give up equity once. It's very difficult to get it back once you've given it up. And so we always knew that in the Series A, we would be giving up a large chunk of equity.
Don't expect that the business case you're starting with is also the one that will be successful.
There are so many stories of unexpected results in investment, innovation, and entrepreneurship on the internet. Do you remember the sudden success of BioNTech's and Moderna's vaccines that were merely developed over one weekend? Or the sudden and unexpected successes of companies like Uber, Facebook, or Tesla? Successes in business, when they happen, often tell only the last part of a story, while all the other parts often remain in the shadow. However, the word overnight is a little bit deceiving. Most businesses that are met with this type of success have put years and years of hard work into their companies, and the success they receive may have been a long time coming. More than likely, the company has been flying under the radar for many, many years, and their overnight success is simply a light being shown on them. Success in innovation and entrepreneurship often means an acquisition or an initial public offering. In his groundbreaking book, From Good to Great, Jim Collins wrote about the flywheel and the doom loop. In the companies his team studied, the ones with outstanding results just kept incrementally improving, learning, making mistakes, and continuing. These efforts created momentum on their flywheel. Overnight success in entrepreneurship often takes years or decades of preparation. That's why I'm sitting down in this episode with Alexander Belcredi and Lorenzo Corsini to learn more about the secrets behind creating overnight successes. Alexander and Lorenzo sold their company Phagomed to BioNTech in November 2021. In this episode, we talk specifically about what it takes to create a sudden and unexpected overnight success. How much effort does it really take to create a flywheel? The speakers in this episode are Alexander Belcredi, who has been working in the pharmaceutical space for over a decade. He spent 9 years at the Boston Consulting Group, where he was part of the global healthcare team focusing on pharma and medtech. While at BCG, Alexander became acutely aware of the urgent need to develop alternatives to antibiotics and was fascinated by the role that phage therapy can play. In 2017, he co-founded Phagomed Biopharma, a biotech company developing phage-based pharmaceuticals to treat bacterial infections. At Phagomed, he served as a CEO and focused on the business and finance responsibilities. Alexander holds a Master of Arts in Modern History and Economics from the University of St. Andrews, as well as an MBA from INSEAD. Lorenzo Corsini has long been fascinated by the many examples of lysines effectively treating bacterial infections and by how underexploited this extremely diverse and abundant natural resource is. Lorenzo spent the last 9 years at the Boston Consulting Group and was a senior principal in his latest role. Lorenzo has advised the top biopharmaceutical companies on how to improve their quality and efficiency in production. Earlier in his career, he worked at Sanofi Aventis in lead optimization after high throughput screening. Lorenzo co-founded Phagomed in 2017 and served as CEO with a focus on the research and development responsibilities. Lorenzo studied biochemistry at Frankfurt University and holds a PhD from the European Molecular Biology Laboratory in Heidelberg. Phagomed Biopharma was an Austrian biotech company on the development of human therapeutic applications of phages and phage-derived proteins. Phagomed had 3 active development programs in the fields of periprosthetic joint infections, urinary tract infections, and bacterial vaginosis. Phagomed had a team of 12 highly skilled scientists working on its programs. BioNTech acquired Phagomed in November 2021. Questions we will discuss in this episode: the decision making process to starting a company, how to build structure, processes, and teams, the reality of fundraising, planability of a sell-side acquisition, the 5 key learnings for first-time founders, and much, much more. I hope you enjoy this episode the same way as I did. Today, I'm happy to welcome to another recording of the Life Science Gets Together podcast, Lorenzo Corsini and Alexander Belcredi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Lorenzo, Alexander, I would like to chat with you about how easy it is to create an overnight success with a company. Last year in November, you were acquired, or your company was acquired by BioNTech. And from what I got from the conversations around this acquisition, for some people, it looked like it happened overnight. And the conversations reminded me of my youth in the 80s when artists or sports people showed up on television for the first time and suddenly won a competition. The people in my environment very often said, look at them. It's such a lucky person. It's an overnight success and it came so effortlessly. And since we have now the age of startups and entrepreneurship, I sometimes get a similar feeling that to some people, it looks like creating a company, creating success is just a matter of being at the right place at the right time. And then fortuna or luck or the universe has to send some positive energy and all happens without doing anything. Let me ask you the first question. How easy was it for you to create your overnight success, Alexander?
So I think, first of all, I think indeed the time it took us from founding the company and then exiting it pre-Series A, that's probably a bit unusual, especially in the biotech space. So I would say it was sort of, in that sense, maybe relatively fast. But I think the reality is we first started discussing about the idea of founding something in 2015. It then took us about 2 years to even gather the courage to actually start up something. And then it took another 3 or 4 years to get to the point where we then were able to make an exit. Mm-hmm. And now in reality, we're still part of the journey. So the entrepreneurial journey continues just as part of a much larger company and corporation. So we're now, if you want, in our 7th year of the Phagomed journey, and the entrepreneurial journey has still not come to an end, even though it sort of came to an interim success.
So I mentioned 7 years, Lorenzo. How was it for you? How was this creating the success? What was your impression?
Look, it was always my dream, in a sense, to start my own biotech company. That's I started dreaming about that when I started to study biochemistry in 1998 or so. And so it took a very long time. I mean, so maybe the actual journey was only 7 years, but in reality, it started with like building the capabilities to do this first during the PhD, then during 9 years of consulting at the Boston Consulting Group. Then in parallel, all the pre-founding work that we did. So I think there is a lot that builds into this and that has to combine and come together to prepare for such an exit.
You said 7 years. It took you 7 years to create from the inception of the company until the acquisition by BioNTech. What was the moment in time when you both sat down and decided to actually found the company? What happened back then? What was this initial event between you two?
So I think the initial event was simply going for lunch as colleagues at the Boston Consulting Group, where we sort of started talking about novel antibacterials and the potential that phages and phage-derived medicines could have in solving us from what's a true humanitarian crisis. Yeah, I mean, the antibiotic resistance pandemic might not be talked about as much as COVID now, but it's a serious problem. And so we started discussing it. And then we sat down after lunch, we sat down over coffee and continued discussing it. And then over the next weeks and months, we kept discussing it. And so I think we had found something that fascinated both of us. I don't think that in 2015, we yet were convinced that we were actually going to quit our jobs and start a company in that direction. And that took a bit of courage to work up because we both have families. At that time, we had very young children. We had a comfortable job.
And I would say it became more and more probable. We started really a consulting style and made slides that we called sort of our pre-founding due diligence. It became more and more probable. At some point, we won a little grant for travel money and organized a symposium where we invited 15 professors in the field of both clinicians who were treating bacterial infections and phage scientists and so on, and had a discussion with them. And after that, that was in a sense a green light. Yeah, they said this totally makes sense. They gave us hints and tips what to start first, what not to start first. That was late in 2016, and after that, basically the whole year 2017 was about. Basically, we were sure that we would start it, but we're deciding when exactly, which steps to take when. Alexander quit BCG first. Then at some point in November, we actually started a legal entity, went to the notary and did all that. And then in December, I quit too.
So if I understood it right, it was about 2 years. And you mentioned that you would like to pick one point that you mentioned. You started with slides. Very often when I talk with people from the United States or from the United Kingdom, they have a different approach. So often I meet people who say, okay, now we have an idea. The next thing we do is starting a company. And you said that you first had this consultancy-like approach. You started with Slide, and at the end of a process, you decided to found a company. Can you explain your reasons why you did it that way and not the Anglo-American way to say, okay, we have an idea, we start a company, and the rest will fall into places?
I think just being afraid of risks. I mean, as a consultant, you have very high opportunity costs. Mm-hmm. So leaving your job and actually quitting it to start essentially all over, because I mean, we had never started a biotech before. So for us, it was starting all over again at a point in our career where we had a very comfortable path ahead of us. I don't think we would have found the courage if we didn't see for ourselves that there was enough space for us to grow a company in, or the competition was in a way not overbearing, or the patent landscape was not yet completely, you know, taken up. So maybe we could have been as successful or more successful by immediately jumping into founding it. But at the end, I mean, we had to convince ourselves. Maybe also to convince our wives. I mean, it took a bit of convincing before we were able to jump over that risk aversion that we had.
And I think to overcome it, I mean, we really wanted to be sure that we're validating whether this could work or not along all the relevant dimensions. And so slides, just because we were consultants and sort of then that's the default tool that you use to write down a train of thought and write down a plan. But it was crucial to analyze systematically, okay, could it work technically? Is there a sufficient medical need? Could there be regulatory problems? Would there be technical problems in producing whatever we wanted to produce? How long would it take from a financial perspective? How much money do you need? Can you get that money by being able to credibly promise investors a decent return? And like all these things need to be thought through, I think, before you really start. Of course, you can build a you can just go to the notary and build a GmbH out of thin air, but like our approach is more be like know a little bit more what you're doing before you actually start.
But I think there's also one point here, and that's, I mean, we're in the biotech space. It's a highly regulated industry. You can take so many wrong turns at every step of the way. And we had been working in the pharmaceutical industry for a number of years. And so we were at least we understood some of it, some of the path that we had to take. And so I think the I also see it now that people are people. A lot of people are excited by biotech because they've seen the success that now came with saving the world from the COVID pandemic. But I think people are also still slightly naive about what it actually means to take a pharmaceutical agent actually into clinical trials and then onto the market, about the length of time that it needs, about the probability of success. And so I'm sure we were also quite naive when we started Phagomed in 2017 or started talking about 2015. But we still had, a good sense of caution in our minds, having worked closely in the field and knowing that, well, you don't just dream pharmaceutical and then you start making revenues the next day. That maybe happens in tech, but it certainly doesn't happen in biotech.
I completely agree to that approach, and I love it. It's a similar approach that I learned in the industry. At Agrana, for example, always think things through first and then act, and not start with acting and then think how things can turn out in future. Knowing that a minimum of 9 out of 10 startups fail, I believe some percentage of that failure rate is due to an early start without having at least thought about the first 3 or 4 steps in the process. Do you see that similar?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it would not have been possible for me, at least, to build Phagomed and scale it and run it without the experience of 9 years of consulting and before even the PhD. So after sort of the typical like college dropout, I don't think that it's really possible in this field to build a successful company and run it without a bit of experience. And then with that experience, you still need to systematically think it through that you're doing the right thing, not just producing great science, but producing great science for a problem that exists in a way that it actually can be solved in the real world.
Yeah. That's true. Alexander, I would like to emphasize one point that you mentioned, that especially in drug development, it takes some time and it's in a highly regulated field. When we look at, sorry to mention the topic, but when we look at the last 2 years, the vaccine development, sometimes people thought it happens in 1 year. Can you explain a little bit from the Phagomed perspective with the phages, what it really takes to take a new medication from an idea stage up to the market, about what time we are talking in terms of your technology?
So I think the first thing to realize is that just because something, you know, works in theory or on a piece of paper doesn't mean it actually works it in the lab. And I mean, that's something that we ourselves found out quite quickly, is that the notion of taking phages into medicine is not as straightforward as simply knowing that a phage will infect and kill bacteria, mainly because phages and bacteria are in an equilibrium in nature. Both simply exist. And in a patient, we don't need an equilibrium. We want to get rid of the bacteria. So we have sort of a natural dynamic that we need to overcome. And a lot of work that we did in the beginning of our company was trying to figure out how do we now get from that idea that we have a natural entity that kills bacteria to a pharmaceutical that is actually reliable once it gets to the clinic. Because it's unfortunately not enough to have success with individual patients. That's great for an individual patient, but to have something that people can use on a regular basis and for a specific indication, you need reliability. And so in our first 2 years, we learned a lot of lessons around what reliable approaches are and whatnot. And if you now look at the lead program that we have, it's not an entire phage anymore. It's just a phage-derived lysin that is a sort of a protein and a simpler to handle entity, where we think we have a much better reliability plus some other advantages. So I think that the initial focus in drug development is around how do you get to a drug that reliably does what you need it to do. And then you need to answer all of the regulatory questions. Is it safe? Can it be produced in GMP? Is it stable, et cetera? We still think that we're pretty fast. So for our lead program, we came up with the sequence in, was it mid-2018, something like that. Mm-hmm. And if you're wondering why I'm looking over, it's because Lorenzo is sitting right next to me here. The And then we're hopefully going to move into a first clinical trial next year. So that would be 4.5 years from, you know, the dreaming it up to a first patient in. And then the clinical path, difficult to estimate, but let's say 3 to 4 years, that's about 8 years that from sort of inception to market, which is quite fast if you look at the average pathway that drugs take, which I think is 10 to 12 years on average. So we still think we have a fast platform, but fast in the context of pharmaceuticals, not fast in the context of, you know, a fintech company, which within a year can have first revenues and within 2 or 3 years can then become a unicorn.
I think this is an important part that you mentioned, this ideation phase at the beginning of the entrepreneurship journey before founding a company, and also taking into account the environment that you're operating in. And as you said, bringing a product from the labs or from basic research to the market is usually a process of 8 to 15 years. And it's worth figuring things out before, and especially in the B2B environment, to go through each single step. Is it possible? Is there a competition on the market? How is the need for the patients before founding a company? Getting the strategic direction right initially helps alongside the way. Would you agree to that, or do you see it differently?
It is a very complex process, and you can take a lot of wrong or you can take a lot of decisions on the way that derail you or add further years. For example, if you go for the wrong first indication, right? If let's say the market or the addressability for that is difficult. So I think what we looked at in Phagomate was always we're trying to de-risk the approach by taking slightly different variations of the same technology at the same time. And so we were looking at different indications with different target pathogens and slightly different products. And in the end, that totally paid out, because the sort of what we were doing in the end was only partially what we thought would be the most straightforward approach at the beginning. Now we started Phagomate thinking that a certain phage product would have been the fastest to market and the easiest to develop, because it was most data on it. So like at the beginning, naively, without having done all the work, it looked easiest. But then it turned out that it was a completely different one that sailed much more easily through all the stage gates and milestones that we had set ourselves. And then at some point we switched and said, okay, now it's the endolysin that's going to be our lead product.
But I think that's where having a strong and also in a certain way diverse. Okay, the two of us are not terribly diverse, granted, but at least in terms of approach, in terms of thinking, where a team that can incorporate multiple perspectives really help, because we have to reinvent ourselves all the time. Mm-hmm. New data that comes in, well, you need to reevaluate. Well, is what you initially thought, is that really going to work? We had to stop programs in the 3 years, programs that we had invested a certain amount of private and public money into. So you need to constantly reevaluate these decisions. And as Renzo said, there were things that we started which would just not have worked in the clinic, and it became apparent. And then you need to take the unfortunate consequences that is not going to be the most successful path. In science, there's always the urge to hope that, you know, the next experiment will change it. The next experiment will show that it does work, and we just didn't think out, you know, we didn't control for the right variables, or we didn't, you know, have the right experimental setup. And I think that's a good attitude up to a point. Once you've seen something not work for 4, 5, 6, 7 times, well, the likelihood that it won't work just becomes quite high. And I think that's something where We did manage to every now and then take decisions which ultimately I think were the right ones, and which brought us to a place where then what we actually had, the data that we had, the technology, the platform, then became so interesting that it led into an early acquisition. But I think that's a very important quality for an entrepreneurial journey, is to think about how to reinvent yourselves at important moments, because it's unlikely that the first things that you start all pan out. Yeah. And so you need to have a couple of shots, and you need to decide when to then turn left or right.
It's an interesting point that you bring up, the dynamics in the beginning of a company, or initially when you start really as a company. How were these first days for you in terms of building structures, building a team, building the processes?
So maybe, I mean, we can tell a couple of anecdotes. Yeah, one of the first things we did, I think already in 2017, without even having a legal entity, we went to the Bio Europe, this big investment and licensing and partnering conference in biotech, and met up, like asked for meetings with a couple of venture capital funds, and we just had our slides, no lab, couple of data from a corporation partner, but no legal entity, no funding, basically nothing, just slides. And we're pitching for a Series A, basically. And they sort of laughed at us, but there were a couple of guys who actually, I don't know if they just found us funny or they engaged like in a serious way, and we started discussing, okay, how does a Series A company look like? And that meant that, we knew, okay, before the Series A, maybe we start with a seed round and set up the structures that make the company investable. But that also meant that although this was a sort of a cold shower in a sense, we knew, okay, we need to, with the first seed money, we need to invest it in a way that afterwards we become interesting for a Series A investor. And the other way around, we needed to already to plan a little bit, how would the Series B investor look like? And accordingly, what do we need to do in a Series A? And accordingly, what do we need to achieve during the seed stage to make this company successful? And so in the end, it was really learning by doing. There was a lot of negative feedback that made us stronger in a sense, because we saw that maybe some parts of our story just didn't, weren't coherent yet, or weren't consistent with a reality in the investment market.
What I think I do remember very vividly is that feeling that you're always behind. You're always behind on where you need to be. Yeah. So you get your first money, great, but really you should already have a lab. Yeah. And then you get your lab, but really in reality you should already have all of these results. Yeah. And then you have a team, but in reality you would need double the team to actually deliver what you need to deliver. So you're constantly sort of playing catch up with where you want to be. And you're sort of, I think in retrospect, those first months, they seem very short because you were constantly trying to troubleshoot something. I mean, we're in Vienna, and Vienna is a fantastic city, but lab space is a real problem. So finding lab space, I mean, that was a constant struggle and until we had a lucky break there. And then, finding the protocols to establish, or finding the bacterial collections to establish your own assays, you're constantly troubleshooting in one dimension or the other. And so I think it's important that even in the beginning, you have a team that you can rely on, and you can really divide up work. And I think that's a bit where I think our journey is maybe also a bit special, in that we started this company on a sort of a partnership also between the two of us, where we felt that we were complementary in our approach, in our capabilities. Yeah. And so, and we were from the beginning able to work together, maybe not always without friction, but very seamlessly, in the sense that that we divided work and we just went out and started, yeah, and got things done over time, and always challenged each other and the rest of the team to really think about, well, what do we actually want to achieve in the next 3 months, 6 months, 9 months? How can we write that down? How can we hold ourselves accountable? And then go back to it and say, well, you know, okay, this we need to adjust, and there we need to move left or right. And so I think that in a sense, we wanted to build a high-performance biotech company. And I do think we succeeded in that. And I think that's probably a part what also at the end was the package that BioNTech found attractive, apart obviously from the science and how that could play out.
Let's stay a little bit at the beginning of the journey before we jump to the end of the journey, or let's say the midterm of the journey, because it's obviously not over. You mentioned two things. I mean, one is the lab space. So it's a call for politicians, build some labs here. We have enough opportunity in Vienna and we need more space. And the second thing I want to point out is what you mentioned, diversity of skills in the management board. And on the other hand, the learnings that you have with going out on the market. And I want to ask you, to a personal question. When I look at entrepreneurship, successful companies always have one trait in common. They do something that nobody else does. But the problem with that is that everybody else tells a different story. And everybody else thinks it's not possible what the entrepreneurs would do. And time and time again, entrepreneurs like you or Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk prove that they are right. And the other people should a little bit amend their reality. What I want to know from you is, how is that from the perspective of an entrepreneur when you know that your approach, your plans are the right ones that help moving society forward, but everybody else says, no, it's not working. It's not possible. Or you should do this and this and that on top of that. How is that for you when you are in the situation?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
Yeah, it's difficult. I think the uniqueness must not be absolute, in a sense that in our case, there were some other phage companies, and we thought that we knew why what we're doing is a little better. It's good to not be the only one trying something or being in a certain field, I think, because then maybe the overall idea is validated in a sense, and you need to make something special, something on top of that. I think what you're doing is right. If it was self-evident that the idea is the right thing to do, then other people would have done it already. And so it needs, I think it needs a good balance between confidence in our own abilities that we can actually make it happen. But at the same time, it needs a lot of insecurity, in the sense that you need to question all the time whether what you're doing is the right thing. And sometimes it's not, and you need to slightly change it. And if you were just saying, oh, I'm doing the right thing and just get on with it, that probably also is not going to work. So it's a very delicate balance.
I think it requires a lot of reflection. So I do think that we, in general, we you meet a lot of people who will tell you, no, not interesting, or no, I'm not going to invest. No, others have tried, it's not going to work. I think the important thing is to take it serious. Because most of the time, people are not saying that because they're trying to discourage you, or because they want to be arrogant, but they've simply made an experience that led them to that conviction, and now it's then your job as the entrepreneur to prove them wrong. But you shouldn't be blind to the fact that these people have good experiences. Yeah, so I think in the end, if I remember back to the beginning, there were a lot of people who told us, "Well, look, you know, taking phages has been tried. We still to this day don't have a clinical trial that shows in which settings they're reliable and efficacious. Maybe think twice about doing something about it. And we did think twice, but not in the sense that we didn't do it. We thought twice about, well, okay, how can we de-risk the approach? What are variations that we can take that help us to understand what will work? Because the fundamental is there. You have an entity which in nature can kill the bacteria, and you have an antibiotic resistance crisis, and we need new antibiotics. So the fundamentals are there. But it's quite possible that we need to learn from what other people have done and do it differently. And I think that's what we always try to do. We always try to push the science in the fields that we entered. And I think our papers and then also our patents show that we've always worked on pushing forward where the field is and trying out new approaches. So I think you do need to be convicted that the fundamentals are correct, but you can still learn from the no's that people give. And I think the reality is you need 50 no's for every yes. Yeah, so it's also just part of the legwork.
Is that 50 or 50 no's for a yes?
I'd say 50.
50. I understood 15. I think the keyword that you mentioned here is the risking approach. Drug development basically is producing for the pharmaceutical industry as a first step, as a small company, and not so much jumping directly to the patient. And when you take this approach that you mentioned, that you did with Fagomet, that you stepwise de-risk your program up to a point where it reaches a stage where it becomes an interesting target for a clinical candidate, and you really can move towards the clinic, it's the point when usually the pharma industry starts getting interested in that. And also with the interest of the pharma industry, investors get interested that not so much invest in the seed stages, but in the Series A stages, which is very close to the clinics. This was my impression of the pharma industry so far. Would you share this perception, or would you like me to amend my perspective on the pharma industry?
So maybe just one comment on that. I would say that we never set out to build a company for the pharmaceutical industry. We set out to build a company for patients and society. And I think it's that's where I wouldn't quite agree with what you said. I think if you try and build something for the sort of the exit case, essentially, I'm not sure you're going to create a lot of value, because I mean, especially in drug development, there are a lot of approaches which sound great on paper, but will they move the needle for patients? Will they have a chance to improve the standard of care? And I think that must be the standard that we hold ourselves to. And to be honest, I mean, if we would be building something for the pharmaceutical industry, well, we shouldn't be developing antibacterials, because the pharmaceutical industry, on average, doesn't want antibacterials. But patients and society do. And so I think we, at least the way we wanted to take it, is find where we can help patients, and yes, find commercially attractive areas where we can help patients, because that's at least the reality for the initial programs that we need to do in this climate, but not just build something that sort of maybe works for the pharmaceutical industry, but then doesn't really take care of the patient side.
But I also think I fully agree. To come back to what you proposed, Christian, I think in every stage of a company you have the different profile of the right investor. Like in seed stage, the probably angel rounds typically work better, because the return expectations are totally different than, let's say, a big venture capital fund. And in a Series A stage for biotech, that round might just be too big for the angels, but might be still too small for those very big funds that fund the Series B, Series C companies. Yeah. So I think for every stage, you have different profiles of investors, and where at which stage big pharma may come in. That may completely differ depending on the profile of that pharma company. There are some who just by definition take only clinically validated assets, so even after Series A, typically then. There might be some, like in the case of BioNTech, that are interested in preclinical assets. It's very, I think the diversity even within the pharma industry and within like all the other types of investors is so large that you, in a sense, you need to find the right one for the right company.
I agree. It makes sense to plan backwards from the patient and then see where you find the right partners for the approach to move things forward, which leads me to the next question. One of my favorite writers is Ryan Holiday. It's a US-based influencer who studies philosophy. And he wrote a book which he titled The Obstacle is the Way. And what I'm interested in from your journey from the start of the company, so you started it in 2017 and then moved it along up to the end. What were the three major obstacles that you had to overcome?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Coaching Conversation 2024. This podcast is 100% dedicated to leadership and leadership within the workplace coaching area. We work with companies throughout the world teaching leaders how to coach their employees. This podcast is dedicated to teaching specific strategies, frameworks, coaching models, and now artificial intelligence strategies to help leaders drive greater teamwork, collaboration, cooperation, greater attitudes, better motivation, coaching career development, just to name a few. I hope you'll check out our podcast.
I'd say one was the technical, scientific, hardcore problems. Mm-hmm. That was definitely one. Another one, maybe the business case, like what would be the business case for a targeted antimicrobial that is independent from the science. Even if the science is great, it's possible that if you bet on the wrong horse with the wrong pathogen or wrong target indication, even if there is a big medical need and everything, and the science is great, it still might not fly. So that's two.
And I think the last one is building the right culture for the company that we wanted to have. So I think we both came from strategy consulting, a super high performance, high reward environment where basically you are willing to put in a lot of hours to make something work. And we now sort of, we shared that culture, but it's clear that the people that you then bring on board into a biotech, they don't have some of the same, you know, reward and interest matrices as maybe some people who enter strategy consulting. At the same time, we really wanted to keep that high performance mindset. We wanted to do things right. We wanted to do excellent science. We wanted to question ourselves at every point in time. We wanted to develop our people. And so it took us a while to figure out which elements of the high performance culture that we knew could be translated into a biotech and how to do things in a way where it then made sense. So I think we have managed to create an environment where we essentially, I mean, everybody in our company works normal work hours. Yeah, we work 40 hours in the week and that's sort of it. And in those 40 hours, we are extremely productive because we found a way to build a culture where we always question ourselves. We always give each other input and feedback. We have flat hierarchies. We have very agile teams. We have very frequent communication nodes where we share information. And that really allows us to get great output every week. But at the same time, within the constraints of a different industry, which is people are here to work. They're not here to build their careers, to, you know, have a super fast career progression towards becoming the CEO of some company. And I think that's something which took us about a year to figure out how to do that right. And we also made some mistakes along the way. Yeah, I mean, we probably took some decisions on team that we shouldn't have taken. But you learn from that. And you need to live with your mistakes. You need to correct them when you have a chance. And then you try out the next variation, the next iteration. And I think that's another thing that I at least think was a big, it was in a sense an obstacle today it's a real asset. We have a fantastic team. We have a huge amount of speed in our programs. And that's great and rewarding to see. And also the fact that we have people who joined us in 2018 and have been able to grow with us, starting as essentially a venture scientist and now being team leaders and then sort of important research leaders in our environment. I think that's also really rewarding to see.
Well, I think this cultural aspect very interesting. Where did you take the energy to shift your perception? You said you started at Boston Consulting Group and had this high performance culture, and then you amended your perspective on the high performance culture to the pharma industry, to the early stage pharma industry. How did you do that? Because I mean, when I look in, especially Vienna, for example, or also in other cities, very often people say, "Okay, this doesn't work. I want this culture. I want to progress in that way." But realize that they deal now with different kind of people, and the result many people have: I give up. I stop the company, which, in my opinion, is one of the reasons why companies fail early stage, because things just don't work. And you made a different decision and said, "Okay, how can we amend that?" What process did you go through to come to that point that you say, okay, we change it and not we give up?
I would say it starts again with questioning what you do every day. So, of course, you can postulate that, we're going to have the same high performance, high reward, high energy culture. But then you need to think, okay, what's a win-win for both sides? For what's a situation where everybody likes to come to work, and how can you foster cooperation, motivation, also positive feedback and learning, and do that at the right level so that it just works. It there's no point in dreaming of like some unrealistic culture. It's about I guess one element, of course, is hiring the right people and taking good hiring choices where you pre-check, you have a good process that gives you a high rate of good hiring decisions where you form a coherent team, where from the beginning you have a good feeling that it, like on a personal level, on a professional level, the cooperation might work very well. But then it's also taking those process decisions every day. How do we interact on a day-to-day and week-by-week basis? What do we, how do we discuss results? How do we prioritize who takes which decisions and who, like, how do we work together to take decisions and to get buy-in for the decisions by everybody, so that they're not just mandated or postulated by the team, but it's really a common decision. And so I think there, I don't think it's one thing. It's many many little elements that start probably with being open for whatever it takes to make the cooperation work.
To sum it up, trial and error.
Yeah, and keeping going. I mean, not giving up, I think, is also one part of the game. You mentioned a second obstacle that you needed to overcome is finding the right business case. Can you shine a little bit more light on that? What the process were that you two were going through towards coming to the point where you said, okay, now we have it?
So we believed from the beginning that one of the reasons why phages, or maybe a bit more broadly, precision antimicrobials, while they're not on the market, is that it's actually not so easy to find a good business case. The antibiotics, we know they have a big resistance problem. But so one could ask, okay, so why don't pharma companies just invent new ones and then we solve the problem? And there is a technical aspect to that it's not so easy to find small molecule antibiotics that are completely new. But there is also a business case angle to that, in that the old antibiotics, they're genericized, low price. They kill typically all bacteria. So you just sometimes there is a bit of specificity, but in general, they're broad spectrum. And so If you invent a new one, nobody will use it because they will put it into, they will use it as last resort for cases where nothing else works. And that is just an impossible business case, because then you just don't make revenue. So from the beginning, we knew, okay, a precision antimicrobial must be something that improves the standard of care in some indication, much above what is possible technically with currently available small molecule antibiotics. And then if it works better, if it helps save lives also beyond the still fortunately comparably rare cases of antimicrobial resistance, then it's technically possible and possible from a business case perspective. But now, how do you find such an indication? And there, I think our systematic consulting style approach was very helpful, because from the beginning, we designed a filter system for, okay, which indications are typically monomicrobial, or where at least only few species play a role rather than wild zoos of bacteria. What are indications with a large medical need, where then the price for such a drug that maybe from a volume will not be so high from a number of prescriptions, but then if the medical need is high enough and the price will be high enough, and then there might be a business case. Where are clinical trials even feasible? That's not the case for every indication. Where is the preclinic feasible in the sense that there are validated animal trials? In which indications is there a scientifically validated causative agent? Yeah, and not just a hypothesis for which bacteria might be responsible. So there is a whole list of dimensions where you need a green check so that it might really work. And we were quite systematic about that. Looked at dozens of different indications and possibilities for applications of precision antimicrobials. We came up with a long list, but it's very specific cases where the medical need is actually very big. But it's let's say you really need to think it through. And it's not the obvious, or it's quite different to how bacterial infections are treated with small molecule antibiotics.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
If you're an engineer or a scientist, you love Formula One, you love cycling, you love learning about how new technologies are changing the world around us, then I thought you may want to listen in to my new podcast, the Neil Ashton Podcast. We talk to leading engineers and scientists from around the world, hear about their life stories, hear about new technologies, and hopefully educate you and give you a better sense of how key things like machine learning, artificial intelligence, supercomputing are changing the world around us. If that sounds like it's something you might like, you should come and have a listen.
Yeah, interesting point. So you went from the ideation phase, which took about 2 years, started then structuring your team and building your processes, and then also spent some time finding the right business case and let's say molding it in a way that it makes an attractive and compelling story to tell, as we are still a few years away from the patient. The thing is then, I mean, this can also be done in private, in one-on-one talks between you two. But at one point in time, it makes sense to go out on the market, and as you did it, to find people who buy into the idea. And I would like to come now to the point to ask you the question, what's the reality of fundraising in the industry? What experience did you make from the day where you said, okay, we found the company, your decision to go out on the market, find investors? And how much time does it take to find, on one hand, the right structure for the financing round, and then the right people?
I mean, it's constantly on your mind. Yeah, I think that there is not a day where you don't, you know, you don't think about, well, how much money do I have? What's my run rate? When do I need to go out again? You're constantly fundraising, obviously, because you're constantly probing the market to see well, can I raise my Series A now? Can I raise it now? Can I raise it now? Yeah. And I think that's important because you constantly get feedback. So we essentially every 2-3 months went to an investment conference. And even if we weren't fundraising, we tried to test the water to see if we could be fundraising or if we could start a conversation that might lead to something. And I think that was crucial in getting feedback along the way. I think initially we were very lucky to have angel investors in our network, a lot of them with entrepreneurship experience and or pharmaceutical experience, who were willing to bet on the two of us, essentially, because that's what you do at that early stage. I mean, the main bet is on the team. Part of the bet is on the science, on the indication and all around that. But if the team's not there and you don't trust in the team, then it's always going to be a difficult sell. So we were lucky to luck is always, it's an interesting dimension. Yeah. But we were at the right place at the right time to find others who believed in us. And we made that interesting choice to combine the public funding with the private funding and to tie the two together in a way that the public side expected co-funding from the private side. And so we essentially told the public side, well, if you give us the money, we'll have the private investment lined up. And the other way around, we told the private investors, well, you'll only have to invest if the public side lines up. That led to a night with very little sleep right before the main funding decision. But it worked out. Yeah, and so before we said, how do you deal with all the no's? Yeah, I mean, that was a clear moment where somebody said yes. Yeah, it's worth to try it. I think also from sort of the public side, this was a good return on investment because of the number of R&D jobs that are now that we're building up in Vienna, that we have built up and that we're continuing to build up. And they took a risk because they also gave us money that essentially could not have brought any return. So in our case, I think one of the advantages of Austria is you can combine these two systems. We have fantastic public funding instruments here, and you can combine that with private investments and thereby leverage yourself by a big factor. Then trying to find the next round of investors, the next ones to join the group, well, that's a constant fight with, am I at the right place and time? Who's out there who would be willing to give me money? Will that get me to an interesting point? And there, I think we always tried to find also creative ways of fundraising. We used convertible loans twice. We did a priced equity round once. We discussed various different funding structures also before sort of then the discussions became an acquisition discussion mid last year. Fundraising is a constant struggle and incubation.
Yeah, and I shared this anecdote before with a sort of failed first Series A request before we even had a lab. But in reality, at that conference, we made a lot of contacts that we kept nurturing, and like we kept sending those people updates and little like mini newsletters, maybe twice a year or so, to just tell them where we are. And actually, they came back to us and asked questions sometimes, or said, "Look, we're closing a new fund now. So are you ready for a Series A? Should we talk again?" So also, like, there is a long term perspective to that, where I think at least us, it helped to be able to paint the picture for the next two rounds, even if it never comes as you planned, right? It's impossible to perfectly predict the future, but showing the potential investors or just contacts you're talking to that you have a plan and you have a currently there is a clear way how to steer the company helps. And keeping also like building up longer term relations over years with some venture capital partners or some angels and like other people who are just in the field who then talk to other people that really helped.
Yeah. I agree to all you say. I think the one factor that is very often underestimated in fundraising is relationship building before people need the money. sometimes I get the feeling that people work in their labs, move the science forward, and then go out on the market when they actually need money. So when they are 3, 4, 5 months away from cash out. And it's the first time when they engage with investors. I think what you did is very smart, to start the process early and always talk with investors, and also getting their feedback, with finding a way not to be annoying with constantly, let's say, chasing the same investor, but with sending out mini newsletters and engaging with people. How much, in your opinion, did that contribute to your success, that you were always on the market and not just said, okay, let's wait a couple of years until we need money and then go out on the market? But how much did that contribute to your success?
I think the it's very difficult to say, because at the end, the path that we took was just unpredictable. Yeah, I mean, it's in a sense, it's probably the bite equivalent of a black swan event, which you don't plan for. Yeah, you don't. It wasn't in our, you know, 2-3 year plan to get acquired. But I think the feedback is just extremely valuable. That constant feedback, you know, going out and getting shot down, it's painful. But okay, well, yeah, you know, you to sit back, take a deep breath, and then you try again. Yeah, and I remember that when I was at conferences in San Francisco, I would adapt my pitch deck between sort of these sessions based on the feedback that I was getting. I was adding in data, taking out data, you know, shifting it around. And I think that's important. The other part which you mentioned, which I fully agree in, is you need to have a long-term view on your run rate and your cash. So we always built the company in a way where we had at least, you know, 6 to 12 months of runway left. And if we felt we were getting, you know, to a year or lower than a year, we started thinking about an interim round to put in place, either to have it as a backup and to know, okay, there's something I can call in, or to actually, you know, put it in place and take the dilution hit. Because you don't want to be in a situation where, A, you need to scale down the team. In our case, we feel like we have a fantastic team. We've invested a lot into the team. And so losing these people because you need to downsize would have been, yeah, I think that would have been dramatic for us. That would not have felt good at all. And it would have been difficult to recover from, to build it up again. And so trying to shape your finances in a way that you're always quite far away from you know, the edge that you might plunge over. I think in our case that was very successful, and also meant that we had a certain, I mean, you're never in the most powerful position if you're negotiating with an investor, just because he has the money that you need to advance. But it at least gave us the peace of mind to hold out on certain decisions, or to also say no to a couple investors along the way and wait for something that fitted better along the way to come along, to be then able to sort of find the right team of investors and not be pressured by the fact that if I don't take this investment now, I don't know how I'm going to pay our wages in 3 or 4 months.
And I'd like to add to that I think there was a lot of learning involved. Like from the first time we talked to venture capital firms in 2017, was slightly naive. With a naive picture of what they want. Then talking again and again to different ones. Yes, in the end, you know, we had talked to BioNTech maybe just 6-7 months before the acquisition and never before. But we had talked to lots of other people, and it took a while to really understand what they want. And there was a there was a certain red line in, or let's say a trend in terms of what do these funds want, what do they need, and it has to be a win-win situation for them to place a bet in a specific company. And I think to be successful there, one needs to understand what they want and what they need and how they work and how these how these funds really make their money and what their worries are, but also what their approach is to develop a company and then to exit out of a company. And if the pitch to the investors. I mean, you're not talking about this 1 5-minute presentation that you give, but really the discussion, what you say in these discussions. If that doesn't take into account what the VCs or other types of investors, what they want, then you won't come together. And it was definitely a learning process for us to understand how this works, how to talk to them, and also understand what they give on trends, and sort of then with our product, we had this women's health keyword in it, and precision medicine, and like all these things. It needs to be like a coherent case on itself. But if you can ring some bells and check some marks in some of these trends that do show up on the decision lists of investors, it's going to be difficult. Or if you do that, it just makes all these discussions much easier.
And then I think you also need to walk away when you feel it's not right. So I remember discussions in 2019 where there was a big ticket on the table, but it would have come with giving up a lot of control on the company. And we had alternatives. And so we were in the position to say no to that. Also remember even earlier, I think it was late 2018, 2019, we were in, I think it was Switzerland, and Medafund was also interested, but simply we didn't see eye to eye on how to develop the company. And so it's a tough decision as a founder, because with more money, you can do more things. You can place more bets. You can advance faster. But sometimes you simply also have to say no when you feel like it's going to change the way the company feels and the way that you can build it. And it's no longer going to be close to where your heart is. And I think there we also said no a couple of times. And now, of course, hindsight is 2020, but obviously it paid out to say no to those specific situations and interests. And I think it helped us stay true to the company that we wanted to build.
I like the approach that you had in raising money. It's not always about the capital. I completely agree to that. It's also about what the funds need, and no fund is created equally. So they have different goals, different perspectives, different structures set up in which they operate. And on the other hand, it's also values. Do you share the same perspective than the investor? Does the investor share the same perspective in developing the company than the founders do? And I like the approach, the words that you used, Lorenzo and Alexander, that you saw it as a learning process and not so much as a transactional process where you just go in, take the money and go home. So where you talked a lot with people. And I think this is something that other entrepreneurs can learn from you, that talking a lot with investors, finding out what their values are and if they're a good fit, helps at the end of the day to mold the company in a way that it becomes an attractive target later in the process. And also what you mentioned, Alexander, initially, this dilution, there's always a discussion about how much control do you give up for capital. But on the other hand, there is always this balance of giving up control, but on the other hand, having the capability of developing the company fast. I mean, like Amazon, I think Jeff Bezos has currently less than 10% of the company, but he's one of the richest people on the planet that has built a big company with only 10%. How important was for you this dilution part at the end of the day? You mentioned a little bit about it already. Can you dig a little bit deeper what your point was to say, okay, this and that must happen, that I'm willing to give up control of the company to gaining the ability to build faster.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Moving is right up there with death and divorce in the stress Olympics. But fear not. Turn that box of woes into a crate of woes with moving tips in the Life Beyond Boxes podcast with Premium Q Moving. Dive into the world of hassle-free moves, learn tips and tricks to save on cash and your sanity. Say goodbye to those moving meltdowns and hello to the smooth sailings. Or should we say smooth movings? Tune into Life Beyond Boxes with Premium Q Moving on lifebeyondboxes.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. And with us, unpack the secrets to a stress-free move.
Yeah, I think at least at the beginning for the first rounds, we wanted to keep the absolute control, like taking budget decisions, worst case alone, all hiring decisions and so on. But of course, there were like the shareholders agreement had some limits as to which, like what sort of sums we could decide on. But fundamentally, we could decide alone on the budget. And that means that you can basically take decisions on the company without lengthy processes and without having to take into account maybe different views by a large investor. And so because the first rounds were with angel investors, their goal was never to have really control. Like every individual investor held just a very small slice of the cake, and in a sense trusted us that we take the right decisions. And I think for the beginning, that is extremely important because there is a huge asymmetry of knowledge and information between we as the management and what the investors know and think, and maybe maybe they even read a paper about the topic, but in general, they don't know terribly much. And so, for us, we knew that in a big Series A, we would have to give up this budgeting absolute power, but that was sort of that was in a sense the red line that led us to say no to that investor that once put a larger ticket on the table.
But I think the dilution sort of you can only give up equity once. It's very difficult to get it back once you've given it up. And so we always knew that in the Series A we would be giving up a large chunk of equity. And so it made sense to be conservative with your equity up front. That also meant that we didn't have a VC on board who would automatically sort of guarantee the next rounds and be an anchor investor next round. We sort of a bit started from scratch in sort of our Series A fundraising. At the same time, I do want to say with regards to angel investors, if you're a GmbH, you always also need to take into account that for the big decisions, you actually need the signature of every single angel investor that you have on the table. So being sort of smart about that and having people who you also trust to act sort of in a joint sense of interest, that's also important. Yeah, and I think that's something that people sometimes tend to forget, that actually having somebody who's invested at GmbH, even if it's a small slice of the pie, he holds a lot of power, he or she, in the sense that that investor. And so making sure that you feel happy with the investors that you're bringing on board, that's also an important part.
Yeah. And I think in terms of dilution, for us, it was always more important to have a perspective that we only do up rounds and we don't have to do a down round. And so it's bad for everybody if like the valuation in the round after this is lower than the valuation of the current round, because it just gives a bad picture and it sets a bad mark and everything, and basically the company's done then. So we tried to be like, of course we wanted to preserve our share, but we knew that, you can't be too greedy in a sense that you have to give up something, because otherwise you might not be able to deliver a decent return in the round after the next. And so it's always really important to think of the round after the next and the round after that. If so many rounds are needed, that you need to have a realistic chance or even a high probability to be able to deliver overall value increases. And if that means more dilution, then it means more dilution, because there's just no way around improving the value in each round.
I agree totally to what you say. And I think also it's a message to investors that the up rounds. There's a reason why people should look for up rounds. It's this creating this feeling of success, because at the end of the day, the founders and also the team of the people in the company who have options give up a bit of equity. And when investors start to negotiate to the death, and I'm pretty sure some experts in negotiation out there on the market, they always risk creating this feeling of being a loser in the team and being a losing team and not being able to push their perspective through in terms of valuation. And I think the last thing an investor in an early stage company should create is this feeling of being in a losing team, and this upfront accepting that initially they get not this big chunk of the pie that they would like to see is key to success also, because as you mentioned, it creates a success feeling. Do you agree to that? Do you see that similar, that it's important to keep the spirit up also from the investment perspective in the team?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's also like a criterion that you should apply to new investors and in deciding whether or not to take somebody. Like if both sides say the long-term success of the company is more important than the valuation that we agree on now, then that's a good sign. If you have the impression there is a too hard negotiation in one or the other direction, and actually I really mean both sides now as the founders, but also as an angel, if you have the impression is this just goes in the wrong direction, you shouldn't do the investment or shouldn't accept the money.
I think we try to steer clear of these sort of take it or leave it offers. Yeah, I mean that's not really how it can work. Yeah, I mean you need to negotiate and you need to find compromises, because at the end of the day, no matter what kind of deal you do, you're negotiating on so many levels. You're negotiating about equity, you're negotiating about control, you're negotiating about strategy. So you need to find to a joint point where each side gets what's most important to them, but then compromises on other areas.
Yeah, and finding a common ground so that the company can move forward. At the end of the day, it's the team that delivers. And when the team stays motivated, it also secures the value for our investors, because the team is moving forward. And especially in our industry, it's not one round of financing anyways. It's several rounds of financing, because it's just it's the reality. I mean, I think to bring one therapeutic to the market, we talk about a few billions in total until a new therapeutic reaches the market. And when you look at the sizes of the funding rounds, it's 400, 500, 600 million later stage companies, also at IPO stage, that the company raises. So this initial seed investment and also Series A's are just the first step towards the success, which leads me to the next question, because coming close to the clinic, companies usually need a minimum of 20, 30 million cash injection. And even you said, you don't plan for an exit, but it's always the question, where does the money come from? And one part of parties that can bring money to the table is actually the pharma industry. And Christoph Langauer in a previous podcast said something very interesting. He said, companies are not sold, companies are acquired at the end of the day. So it's not that a company can plan to be sold. It's the other way around. Companies should plan for, as you said, going to the market. And then sometime it might happen that a company comes along. Can you shine a little bit more light on the reality of an acquisition? How planable is such an event as an entrepreneur?
Well, unplanned event are also that the computer runs out of battery. So give me a second to get my table and I'll leave that question to Lorenzo.
Yeah, so like in our case, it was not planned at all. We didn't anticipate that this could even happen, because our expectation was very firmly acquisitions are possible after a clinical proof of concept, but not in the or very rare, let's say, in the preclinical stage. So in our case, it was I had an idea for a potential cooperation, and it was really just a scientific cooperation to explore something. We approached people we knew at BioNTech, and then we actually started discussing about a scientific cooperation. And we discussed it for a while. Then sort of when they got the feeling that this could really be something interesting, and we started also saying that we're raising a Series A and that we're looking for funds. It came from them. We never asked for an investment by BioNTech. They proposed it because they liked the approach. And then somehow the discussion gradually turned from investment into Series A, and it's clear that if a strategic investor starts with an investment and at the same time a scientific cooperation, there is potential for conflicts of interest because as a strategic investor, there is always the option of a full acquisition at some point in the future, and then there are valuation discussions. But as in a that might not be aligned with the interests as a scientific cooperation partner. And so, like the pure Series A turned out to be technically difficult, and then the discussion continued in the direction of an acquisition. It started maybe in around Easter 2021, so in April, and then came to a conclusion in October. So it was 6 months overall that we had this transition in the discussion from potential scientific cooperation to an investment into the Series A to a full acquisition.
7 months is pretty quick. So it's from the start to the end. How dynamic was the process? So when we talk about the technical process, is it just like, you start with a scientific collaboration, then you discuss over lunch, now let's do a Series A. And at the end of the day, in the evening, then the parties come back and say, no, we acquire you. Just sign here. Here's the check and everything is done. How intense is the process at the end of the day when we talk about the reality of an acquisition?
It's extremely intense. I think it's even more intense if you're negotiating for, you know, your job, because I mean, it's your job. You're the managing director of the company. You're negotiating for the company. You're negotiating in a certain way for the entire team who has contributed to building something, who sort of are a big part of it. And at the end, you know, they also want to be part of something that continues in some form. And then you're negotiating for your stock, which is at that point a sizable part of your personal assets. So it's extremely intense. I definitely know that I started sleeping rough towards the end of that process. And you constantly face lots of new developments. Yeah, I mean the going from an Series A discussion to an acquisition discussion, that's a roller coaster. Yeah, and then at some point we move back to the Series A discussion, and then we move back to the acquisition discussion. It's really very intense. And it's also, I think that's the same for both sides. I mean, both sides are constantly trying to probe and to understand, can this actually work? You have a due diligence ongoing at the same time, obviously. So the other side is probing, well, does what you say match up to what you've done? And then lots of small things suddenly come into play. I remember we had a discussion in late 2020 where those in our management team who are much more experienced in biotechs started really pressuring us to start codifying a lot of the knowledge into formal development reports. And that turned out to be a fantastic suggestion and nudge where in the diligence, we actually had a lot to show, because we not only done a lot, we'd also spent time, and it was an entire month where the entire team was writing reports in last January. We actually also spent the time then preparing ourselves for what we thought was going to be a Series A, but it became much more relevant in an acquisition discussion.
So what I found most challenging about this whole process is really the asymmetry in emotions. Yeah, for us, we negotiated personally, but the counter side usually was then lawyers, for example, IP lawyers, other lawyers, all types of lawyers. And so then then sometimes, I don't know, just as an example, they came up with a new paragraph that would cover a theoretical risk that only lawyers can come up with. We didn't want that, say no, but like they like if the counterpart is much less emotional, they just say, yeah, but I want that paragraph, full stop. And I really don't freaking care if this deal goes south, I want my paragraph. You know, and then that's sort of on our case, it wasn't just a paragraph, it was the whole company and the deal and like the future. So that gave us like a couple of tough months in summer last year when these discussions were ongoing.
And it was also a tough month for the company, I think, because it meant that obviously it was difficult to share with the full team what was going on. And as Lorenzo said, we actually typically were very open and shared most of the good and bad things that were happening left and right. But here, something so transformative for the company, it's difficult to share until it's really done. And so that, I think, also introduces an element of stress into the company, probably also into our families, because it becomes the overriding topic. How are you negotiating? Where is it going? And is it going to get to a conclusion? I think in retrospect, once you are that deep in the discussion, there is a good chance that this is going to happen. But being in that situation, you see more of the risks around what you still need to do or what could derail the whole discussion than having sort of the confidence that it will work out somehow.
Yeah, when I think back to my days at the university in the 90s when I was a student, the textbook always looked very simple of an acquisition. You have your few steps and here is the process and you walk through. And once you sit in the reality of an acquisition, you realize very quickly that human beings also have emotions that come into play and the process can become very dynamic. It's good to hear also from you that it's not only me that sees that reality, that also you experience something similar. Which brings me to the next question. Let's tap into the key learnings of your process. You made a wonderful story. You created a wonderful story from 2015 with the first steps up to this, let's say, interim success point, because your story isn't over, obviously. You're now part of the acquiring company and continue building your technology forward. But within these 7 years of developing from a startup company into, let's say, the scale-up company, into becoming an acquisition target for, meanwhile, one of the biggest players in the European market, what were your 5 key learnings that you would like to share with other entrepreneurs?
5. So maybe I do 2 and then...
we can make it 6 already. Also, or 4, as you like.
I think one is to invest in your team. I think that's something that we always tried to set us at times to really invest into what we had. For example, we early on decided that we wanted to do weekly training sessions where we take an hour out of the entire team and we train something and we cross-train. So somebody who's good at a specific thing teaches the others about it. We invested into our processes. We have SOP schemes and systems, which are maybe on par with some of the bigger companies out there, because we felt we wanted to very early on standardize certain elements of what we do. And so we always tried to invest beyond just the science really into us as a company. And I think that's one thing that certainly also drove success in building up a high-performance team and allowing us to actually deliver the fantastic science that we've been delivering so far.
The next one I would say is don't expect that the business case you're starting with is also the one that will be successful. When we started, we also pitched to the investors, to the angels invested in us. We explained them what we wanted to do. And so just changing that, you can't just do that, right? They invested into something, you can't just change that. But on the other hand, you actually need to reevaluate with every piece of new results and developments that you have, also with feedbacks that you get from institutional investors, for example, reevaluate your business plan and adapt to what looks the most promising thing to do, which might be very different from even what you pitch to your initial investors.
Maybe a third one, be transparent. I think we always try to be very transparent to our investors, where we took a lot of effort to send monthly updates, do quarterly calls, and just keep them up to date. We even had a WhatsApp group where we shared sort of smaller updates on the team or a picture of something just to keep people engaged. But also with the team, we had weekly all staff meetings. We tried to be very transparent about the plans for the next half year, what we were all working on. And I think that's helpful to build a feeling that we are in this together and we are working on a joint mission to achieve something great. And everybody sort of knows where we're heading and what the next big steps are.
And like the next one, I would say, don't wait as long as we did to start the company. So do it much earlier. I was probably 40 already when we start, or no, even 38 maybe when we started to think about it. And so that, like, when you're there, you have kids probably already, and so there. A failure would have been very painful. Starting earlier, at a slightly earlier stage in life, it's probably easier to maybe take a hit, even start something new, rather than when you're already older and you have invested more in a company. And I think in retrospect, it could have started much earlier, right? If with a bit more risk appetite, you can just do it. I know even of people who first quit their jobs without an idea and then started thinking with a clear head, instead of sort of continuing. In our case, we continued at quite like engaging and stressful job for quite a long time and doing this in parallel, instead of deciding first, okay, I want to be an entrepreneur and now I'm going to think about what to do. And I know of people who have done that very successfully. I think if I could decide again, I would probably start earlier with building a company.
And then just to make it five, don't be discouraged by negative feedback. See it as a chance to reevaluate where you're going and to then come to one of two conclusions. One is, they are wrong and you are right, and you just continue the path that you've chosen and you have good reasons for believing that. Or maybe there's some truth to it, and then figure out how to adapt the path that you're taking. Sorry.
Yeah.
I agree to everything you say. I wrote it down as five: invest in your team. I would say the second part, expect change, be transparent. How can we phrase it? Don't wait too long to start the company. It's always the right time to start something new, I would say. And I think the fifth was also, it's very great because it taps into failed culture. Don't be discouraged, just continue and don't stop. Great advice. Alexander, Lorenzo, let me ask you one final question. When entrepreneurs are out there that are listening to the podcast episode and go through these 5 points and say, okay, I feel now the spark to start a company, what's the first step that you would recommend to take?
Find the right people to do it with. Recognize that you yourself are probably not going to cover all the elements of what you need to be successful, and start by building your team.
Yeah, and I would add to that, like a slightly complimentary, talk to many people about it. Like, don't be afraid to discuss it and get feedback on the idea, develop it further, because many brains are very synergistic. It's much more than the sum of the thought processes. And probably on the way you will find potential partners, but on the way you'll also find refinement to your idea and improvements and validation.
Alexandre Lorenzo, anything to add to this episode that I forgot to ask?
It's fun.
Yeah,
maybe that's the last part. Building a company is tough. It's stressful, but it's also really fun to see how something grows and what it can develop into. So maybe if we talked a lot about what you need to get right and all of the things you need to take care of and the negative feedback, it is extremely rewarding.
Yeah, it's rewarding. It's a different way of life than going to work, having a boss and doing sort of what the bosses of the company tell you. If you're as an entrepreneur, you can take your decisions and really shape something and make something completely new that nobody's ever done before. And I think that's extremely exciting, especially if what you're doing is serving a deeper purpose, like addressing a huge medical need, like the antimicrobial resistance crisis, probably one of the big crises of humanity, of human medicine, and working on that is motivation by itself. And if you can shape your own way and define your own path, I couldn't say it better. It's just deeply rewarding and really a lot of fun.
I believe that. Alexandre Lorenzo, thank you very much for your time. And I wish you too and your team all the best in the new roles. I think it's now BioNTech R&D Austria, if I remember it right. Yeah. And you're the general managers. Did I remember that right?
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to see your technology coming to the market in a few years.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us. And thanks everybody for listening in.
Have a great day. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Did you like the episode? Then please, please, please leave a 5-star review on Spotify and Apple and make sure that you like, comment, and share the YouTube episode. It helps that the algorithm delivers the episode to people who also benefit from it the same way than you did. Have a great day.